using the internet or cell phones to threaten, spread rumors, or post doctored photographs.
Well, police in Western Massachusetts are investigating an apparent suicide by a teenage girl and the role cyberbullying may have played.
A 13-year-old girl has been forced to move schools after a bully posted fake nude photos of her on Facebook. She's pleading for more to be done to help victims of cyber hate.
Problem that leaves kids and teens feeling helpless, depressed, and possibly even suicidal. Now, as Ross Lord reports, two new studies are exploring the prevalence of cyberbullying and cyberstalking, what's likely to make teens violent.
According to recent studies, this kind of bullying is on the rise. By one count, as many as one in three kids is being victimized.
Let's get more now on the concerns about cyberbullying after the Prime Minister called on users to boycott sites that don't provide adequate safeguards. David Cameron was responding to the case of Hannah Smith, the 14-year-old who died after receiving online abuse via the social networking site Ask.fm.
Hidden in plain sight are countless stories of victimization through online harassment. And most troubling, we don't really have any good solutions for dealing with these problems. We're going to look at how we got here, how the internet became this place of unregulated hate speech, and what more can be done if we want to turn the tides before it's too late. And we'll look at what this means in the context of our university campuses, where an interesting and related debate over free speech has sprouted. As always, we're not going to arrive at all the answers, but along the way, hopefully, we'll learn something about the history and future of this thing we call the internet. So how did we get here? As you heard in those news reports, the victims of online harassment are most often women. The other group that's most often targeted are minorities. And if this isn't your experience of the internet, if this is news to you, John Oliver has something he'd like to tell you.
I'm talking about the kind of direct threats that can make people fear for their safety. And if you're thinking, well, come on, that doesn't seem like that big a problem, well, congratulations on your white penis. Because if you have one of those, you probably have a very different experience of the internet.
Why has sexualized and racialized violence made itself so prevalent on the internet? To help me understand that, I had to get some help.
My name is Taylor Owen. I'm a professor at the Graduate School of Journalism and the Liu Institute for Global Issues.
And as a student at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism, I didn't just reach out to Dr. Taylor Owen because that was the easy thing to do. As the author of Disruptive Power, The Crisis of the State in the Digital Age, he's an expert on these global internet issues. If anyone is going to be able to help me understand why the internet allows people to treat each other so poorly, I'm confident that it's him.
The internet is largely dominated, like I said, by these four or five companies who have a very particular business model that incentivizes all speech of any kind and monetizes it because it creates data and engagement. And engagement is a very bad metric for civic discourse. If I tell you I hate you, I'm engaging with you. If I use racialized or sexualized violent language against you, I'm engaging with you. And in a social media environment, that is a good thing. And that's created a really toxic civic discourse, I think.
But to really understand how these four or five companies, which are Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, and Facebook, have become so focused on incentivizing speech, we need to go back in time to when all this began.
The internet was largely an American creation. And it was, while it was originally a government-funded creation, it very quickly transferred over to an U.S. entrepreneurial new economy. And deeply embedded in that, the values and the ideologies of that economy was a very American notion of both entrepreneurialism and the free market, but also free speech.
So the notion of free speech contains within it the democratic values of openness and transparency. And these are also very American values.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it.
And so I think those twin ideologies almost.
And just to reiterate, Dr. Owen is referring to free speech and the free market.
We're just embedded in the internet from the beginning. In the early stages of the internet, that meant that it was structured in a very decentralized way that actually had a very empowering dynamic to it, in that it countered some of the ways society was organized throughout most of the 20th century. It challenged the media institutions, the governance institutions, international organizations, corporate structures, because of that embedded decentralization that was in it. But that also means that that notion of free speech and uncontrollability that existed in that model, and kind of rampant free marketism, was also embedded. And 20 years later, that has had a host of consequences, I think, that we're sort of seeing play out now.
For exercising their constitutional rights to free speech.
The freedom of speech simply does not apply to offensive speech, there is that asterisk.
Well, the president has free speech rights too.
What's in a name? Potentially a great deal. University of Toronto psychology professor Jordan Peterson has a fight on his hands after objecting to proposed legislation that he says would violate his freedom of speech by forcing him to address transgendered people using the pronouns of their choosing.
And from these twin ideologies, notions of free speech and free market entrepreneurialism, came things like this.
I'm constantly aware of the fact that there's an enormous amount of hate directed towards me.
Hate in the form of bomb threats, rape threats, even death threats.
They told me they were coming to kill me. When someone posts your address online and they tell you they're going to murder your whole family, you don't really feel safe staying at that location.
Unfortunately, it gets even worse than those examples. The uncontrollability of this notion of free speech that was embedded in the internet has manifested itself in countless examples of a new kind of online misogyny and sexual violence.
Holly Jacobs was 26 and a PhD candidate when her life suddenly turned upside down. Naked pictures she had sent to her boyfriend years before showed up on the web. But unlike sexual assault, in most of the country, so-called revenge porn is not a crime.
Her case is an extreme example of what's known as revenge porn. Advocacy groups refer to it as non-consensual pornography, and they consider it a form of sexual abuse.
Revenge porn, when a picture becomes something better not remembered.
For the record, I didn't add those camera clicking noises to the end of that news clip. So from its origins, the internet fostered libertarian ideals, like the absolute freedom of speech in an unregulated market economy. And over time, it developed into a place where people's lives were being ruined.
I received an anonymous email at work that a profile had been created of me. Someone was pretending to be me, and there were nude pictures on this profile. So I Googled my name, and the porn website XHamster came up. And there was my first and last name, the name of the college where I teach, the town where I live, and a solicitation for sex. My actual thoughts were, this is my life. This is never going to end, so I need to end my life. Because I could not live like that. So after I found the profile, I attempted suicide.
My stomach dropped. I honestly could feel myself turning white. I just felt like my life was ruined.
It was overwhelming. It was very, very violating. I felt as if nowhere was private anymore. It never dawned on me that that would end up being put online with my personally identifiable information in a campaign against me. It didn't dawn on me that people did that.
They started popping up on sites every 6 months, and then all of a sudden I started dating somebody new in November of 2011. And they went viral.
And at times, the picture would come up and your name and contact information would accompany it, which is becomes a dangerous situation.
Yes, absolutely, because you have people. I mean, my email address was attached to these, and so I had harassing emails constantly coming in. My work location was posted up there, and so I was terrified. I was so afraid that somebody would physically stalk me.
It affected my ability to walk into any interview. The second I walked in, shook their hand, and sat down and looked them in the face, I just wanted to look away and crawl under a rock and die because I don't know what they've seen, if they've seen anything, and I didn't know how to bring it up. I wasn't present.
These kind of things happen at UBC, too. The Digital Tattoo Project was contacted by UBC Security last year about cases of something called sextortion happening on campus. Students were engaging in online sexual activity through video chat or other means of image sharing. The person on the other end was then using these sensitive images and videos to blackmail the student into sending money. If the student didn't send the money, the blackmailer threatened to send the photos and the videos to friends and family. And even if the student did send the money, the blackmailer would still ask for more and more and might release the images and videos anyways. This is sextortion. And like revenge porn, it's a real thing and happens everywhere. And often, our laws aren't equipped to deal with these horrific crimes.
I would stay up almost all night every night just in a little cave of a dark hole online, just finding more and more and more. Law enforcement straight up told me, how do you want us to help you? How do you think that we can possibly help you?
I did go to lawyers in 2010 to handle this civilly. And the first one said, well, you know, you really should get better boyfriends. I won't take this case. The second one I approached said, well, it's going to be a $5,000 upfront retainer, and this could run anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 when all said and done. I'm a single mom of two. I work two jobs. I don't have $5,000, never mind $15,000.
Now, those examples are from the United States, and those stories are from a few years ago. Here in Canada, in 2014, the then ruling federal conservatives passed Bill C-13, or Protecting Canadians from Online Crimes Act. While it finally introduced legislation that criminalized things like revenge porn, it also had some very serious problems. Problems so serious that critics, like feminist advocate Steph Guthrie, who's been an outspoken advocate for survivors of revenge porn, would have rather seen nothing at all than that bill.
I do think that the bill would be better off designed to address people who specifically know that consent was not a factor in the image capture and are choosing to share it anyway. Most of the criticisms of this bill have centered around the fact that really it seems to be using the revenge porn issue as a kind of front to usher in these lawful access regulations that that the federal government tried to implement a while ago with Bill C-30. There have been some small changes to it, so lawful access, as it was defined in Bill C-30, internet service providers were compelled to provide information about internet users if law enforcement requested it without a warrant. So the old version of the bill compelled ISPs to do that. This version doesn't compel them to. However, it removes any liability for them if they choose to, if they volunteer to share that information with law enforcement.
Which we know they already do, and this just provides further legal cover for them to do so.
Exactly. I mean, it really gives them the sense that they can do that with impunity, and perhaps more importantly, it gives Canadian citizens the idea that if you know that ISPs can do that with impunity, it's sort of a chilling effect where you're going to be where you're going to be very careful about everything because you know that your ISP could share it with the police.
And so, not specifically in the case of you being accused of cyberbullying or of revenge porn, in any case.
In any case, yeah, absolutely.
This is a surveillance bill.
Absolutely.
But the internet hasn't always been this way. I mean, it doesn't only do bad things like spy on people. We should stop for a minute here and talk a little bit about the good things that have happened because of the internet. And more specifically, the good things that have been allowed to have happened because of what Dr. Owen describes as the twin ideologies that were embedded during its inception.
There was a moment of legitimate, empowering activity and infrastructure on the internet. And we saw that play out in some really fascinating ways. The diversity of voices that was enabled, the empowering of activist movements that was enabled, the new commerce that was enabled, all of those things had a real empowering dynamic to them. But I think something's changed now.
And we saw a bit of that when we looked into the story of Aaron Schwartz in episodes 1 and 2. And in exploring his story, we also got a glimpse into how the internet has changed. But for a little bit more context, here's Dr. Taylor Owen again.
So one of the consequences of the evolution of the internet has not been this wonderful decentralized network of actors taking on established powers, but actually now the emergence of 4 to 5 very large internet companies that largely control what we experience online and control the economy of the internet.
And these companies, they're looking to make money. That's part of the free market entrepreneurial spirit that the United States embedded within the core of the internet's values. How do they make money? As Dr. Owen said, they're incentivizing engagement on their platforms. And that means that they're also powering ahead with the full force of freedom of speech to allow their users to do and to say pretty much whatever they want, so long as they're engaging. And we've seen how this plays out on the internet in the examples of online harassment and revenge porn. But that's not to say that nothing can be done to change these trends. As we've just discussed, Canada has passed federal legislation that criminalizes revenge porn and gives victims a legal means of recourse. Unfortunately, the criminal court isn't perfect, as the burden of proof rests with the victim, meaning the person whose intimate images have been shared online has to prove that the perpetrator didn't have consent to distribute the images. So media commentators have come up with an extrajudicial solution that's so simple, you pretty much have to be a moron even to think of it.
How best to avoid this problem? Experts say don't take pictures and then share them.
I think that the teachable moment and the takeaway is you just can't take these pictures.
You know what? Don't take naked photos of yourself. Listen. One of the solutions to the problem is don't take pictures of yourself naked. Okay, we've said that.
Good point. But kids, don't take pictures of yourself naked and put it on the internet. It's going to come up some point.
And what if it doesn't come up until you're a parent and then you got to explain that?
And again, here's what John Oliver has to say about that.
What the f*** are you talking about? For a start, not taking pictures doesn't always work. Sometimes these photos come from hacked webcams. But regardless of that, it doesn't matter how it happens. Because here's a fun game. Insert any other crime into those same sentences. Listen, guys. If you don't want to get burgled, don't live in a house. If you're a parent, how are you going to explain that break-in to your kids?
And here's how some survivors of revenge porn have responded to that solution.
There are people, Holly, who are going to look at you and say, you know what? You shouldn't have taken the photos in the first place. And when you take photos like this, you should always think they may eventually end up online. How do you respond to that idea?
It's absolutely just a new version of victim blaming. And what I would say to victims when they hear that is just hold on to that little voice inside of you that says, this is not right. What's happening to me is not okay. And there need to be laws in place against this. And stand up, you know, stand up for what you feel is right. It's not okay that people are doing this and exploiting you just because you trusted somebody and because you shared intimate photographs in an intimate relationship. That's not the problem here. What's the problem is that somebody is using this against you and trying to drive you to suicide. You know, they're ruining your lives. That's not okay.
And finally, here's Steph Guthrie talking about victim blaming.
We really have a tendency to blame the person who allowed themselves to be naked in any situation and allowed themselves to have a photo taken. We as a society are much more comfortable blaming the person who consented to an image being captured in the first place under very specific circumstances, yeah, wherein the expectation was obviously that this was for the other person's private use.
But these notions of free speech aren't universal. In most countries, the relationship between your right to freedom of speech and other people's fundamental rights to equality create a dichotomy. But not in the United States, where the internet was developed.
The American notion of free speech is absolutist. right? They have the First Amendment protects fundamentally people to say almost anything. That is very different than what free speech means in many other Western democracies, let alone the rest of the world. Notions of free speech in Europe particularly, but also in Canada, are limited. And they're limited to protect the rights of minorities, to protect minority groups, to protect the rights of whatever it might be, right? Like, that we have limits on speech for very, very real reasons. But those don't really exist in the United States. But the internet is now global. So there's a conflict in some real ways between the ways governments and societies have decided to control speech and the way the internet works. And there's a conflict there.
And as a bit of an aside, we're beginning to see this conflict play out on university campuses. UBC just issued a statement about freedom of speech that really didn't say much aside from noting that there's an issue. And this issue has largely risen to prominence because of a University of Toronto psychology professor who refuses to refer to LGBTQ students by their chosen pronoun. There's also a bill in front of the House of Commons at the moment that's trying to write being able to choose your pronoun into the law, a measure that stands for equality and equitable treatment for all Canadians. But this U of T professor believes that it infringes on his freedoms of speech. And that tension, which we're seeing playing out on Canadian campuses, is the very same as the one on the internet. But not everyone is going to stand for it. The European Union is actively taking steps to regulate the internet in some very progressive and interesting ways. I asked Dr. Owen if the EU was trying to regulate the internet. So what is happening in Europe then with these, with the right to be forgotten, these huge fines that they're levying against tech companies? Are they trying to regulate the internet?
Yes, and absolutely. And I think they're trying to do it in two main ways. They are trying to regulate the, and they twin up with the two ideologies that are embedded in the internet, the free market ideology and the free speech ideology. They are on the free market side. They are trying to govern the increasing monopolistic behavior of the internet platform companies. And from the European point of view, they're going after this using antitrust regulation and cases. And they're going to try and break up the operations of these five platform companies inside Europe. And I think that's sort of a big ambition and a big statement, but I have no doubt that's their objective. They do not want Google to exist, for example, in Europe as a single entity. And that's a big deal, right? Google is just a massive company. And it will force them to really change the structure of their organization in Europe. So that's on the corporate side, right? They want to break up this what they perceive as anti-free, anti- or monopolistic business practices that are against the economic interests of Europe, right? So that's on the free speech side. This is where they're going after data and data protection and privacy. And the new data protection laws that are being rolled out in the next year in the EU are incredibly aggressive. And they force companies to have to release and provide data, the records of the data, their transparency around the data collecting about all of their activities and all of the data they collect about anyone who uses their services. And in the internet, where the internet economy is driven by the monetization of data, this is a huge deal. Because these companies have been really on this race to collect as much data as possible in order to monetize it. And that bumps right up against this new data, these new data privacy laws in the EU. So this is kind of, Europe's kind of ground zero for this fight right now. And it's going to play out in the next couple of years.
And what about in Canada? Well, the Saskatchewan provincial government just announced that they're going to change their tort law to allow victims of revenge porn to sue their perpetrators in civil court. Manitoba is the only other province in Canada that has already allowed this legal recourse. And while this circumvents some of the burden of proof that's so problematic in criminal court, suing someone in civil court is expensive. Remember the testimony from Anne-Marie, the victim of revenge porn in the U.S.? A lawyer told her that they required a $5,000 retainer and the trial could run another $10,000 to $15,000. These costs are prohibitive. The only other thing that's happening outside of Europe are that these companies that control the internet are offering to help victims on a volunteer basis. Google, Microsoft, and Facebook are now offering assistance to victims of revenge porn. But are they doing this out of benevolence? Or is this just a way to avoid the kind of regulatory pressures that they're experiencing in Europe? And do those regulations really even work?
I mean, it's interesting, you have to dig into what we mean by work, right? I'm not sure that these laws are intended to literally work for each incidence of personal wrongdoing, right? So I'm not sure that for any individual who faces the exploitation of their data or the types of sort of challenges you're discussing in this episode, right? Like around exploitation and ransom. And I'm not sure it's going to solve the problem for any one individual. I think the objective of these laws is to force structural change inside the ecosystem of the internet. And that's a much bigger ambition, right? That goes beyond the nuances of any one individual experience in the internet. I think, for example, saying that a company has to be able to give you the data they collect about you, whether or not people end up using that or making that request, it changes the way the company stores data about people, the way they build their databases to allow them to access data about any individual, where they store that data. Not just in some server somewhere in the world, but actually in the home country of the country that the citizen lives, right? Like, these are major structural changes to the operation of these companies. And I think that's the goal, not just any individual request that might come out of it. And the only thing way, I fear the only way we roll that back is by structurally changing those incentives, the incentives to monetize engagement in these platforms, and the companies aren't going to do that themselves. So that's where it ultimately, I think, it comes back to governments in this, that we're going to be in this moment of regulation building. And I don't think we know what that's going to look like yet, because it's not the same as regulating old industry or old media. But I'm not sure how else we reverse this negative trend that we're seeing.
So I think you kind of answered my next question there. I was going to ask you, should we regulate the internet? And it seems like you're suggesting that we should regulate the internet. It's just how that might happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's inevitable that we will. I mean, it's like you said, it's remarkable that we really have it. That this thing that has such a profound role in our economy and our lives is largely untouched, and has been allowed to grow in a way that has been unfettered by government intervention, largely. So I think we are going to start doing that. The challenge is that there is a predisposition of governments to force new technologies or new organizations into existing regulatory structures. So that's why you see a lot of talk about, for example, should we call Facebook a media company and a publisher, right? And that what that is implying is that governments want to fit Facebook into the regulatory environment that they already put publishers in, right? And that I don't think is going to work, because these companies are something different. They're not the same as, you know, Facebook is not the same as the New York Times. They're different types of institutions. And that is fine. That doesn't mean that Facebook shouldn't be regulated. It just means we might not be able to regulate it like we regulate the New York Times or the Globe and Mail in Canada or whatever, right? So I think what we need, and this is probably where the EU is ahead of, certainly ahead of Canada, is we may need new regulatory mechanisms in order to push back against these institutions or to bring them into our norms of society. They just can't be the old model. And that's a governance problem, right? That needs new governance mechanisms. And we're not very good at doing that, right? We like governing like we did before. And that there's a real challenge there.
Thanks to Margot Smith and Alexander Kuskowski for their editorial help on the episode. A special thanks to Dr. Taylor Owen for being on the show. This episode featured music by Lee Rosevere. If you like the show, subscribe on iTunes. You can visit our website, digitaltattoo.ubc.ca, to find more resources and information about sextortion and other digital identity issues. I'm Brian Short. Thanks for listening.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T.